certainly some of the intelligence analysts felt that they were being pressured to make their reports fit a preconceived policy.
It's so sad that this report took 6 months to be given to the public. It shouldn't have taken that long.
If everything goes as he said, in the next 3 weeks or so, you'll have about 3,000 ECOWAS troops in Liberia.
We definitely feel that this is a political prisoner status that we will hold.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, July 25th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. House and Senate Select Intelligence Committees released a 900-page report yesterday detailing the results of its 10-month investigation into the security lapses surrounding the events of September 11, 2001. Speaking at a bipartisan news conference, members of Congress, including Democratic Representative and Committee Co-Chair Bob Graham, as well as Republican Representative and House Intelligence Committee Chair Porter Goss, placed blame upon the FBI and CIA for failing to heed repeated warnings that Al-Qaeda planned to launch attacks within the U.S. Also in attendance at the news conference were several family members who lost loved ones in the terrorist attacks. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke this afternoon with Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband Ronald Breitweiser was killed on the 94th floor of the World Trade Center, Tower 2.
I think my initial reaction was twofold. First, as a United States citizen, I was just disgusted with the many missed opportunities that our intelligence agencies had to thwart the attacks by the terrorists. What came to mind was that how many lives could have been saved. Certainly the damage of September 11th could have been minimized to some degree had the intelligence agencies not failed so horribly on that day. And I think my second response came as a 9/11 widow, and that was just utter sadness that my husband could in fact have been one of those lives that could have been saved.
Just how much of this 900-page report have you had a chance to look through?
I was fortunate when I went to go pick up my copy of it in the morning, I was able to attend a press briefing given by the staff director, Eleanor Hill. So she sort of gave the Cliff Notes version of the report. So I got a pretty good idea of what was in it, what was not in it. So yeah, I have a fairly good idea. I haven't had a chance to actually sit down and read it, though.
From what you've heard so far, was there anything in this report that surprised you, or was it pretty much as you expected?
I think for the most part, there were really no surprises for me. I mean, we've done so much research in the last 22 months that really there wasn't any big surprise. Certainly, I was upset to hear that there were 14 open investigations being done by the FBI that linked the terrorists, you know, that were involved to terrorists to some degree. We had been told prior to the release of this report by the FBI that they did not have open investigations on the terrorists. I you know, found that a surprise that there were 14 open investigations by the FBI. You know, it was also a surprise to see what was not in the report. Certainly, it's upsetting to see blank lines. And I think that one of the problems that we're facing at this point in time regarding 9/11 is the overclassification of materials involving it.
Do you think that there was much intelligence information that was left out of this report?
You know, obviously, I haven't seen the classified report. I never will. But my understanding is that there is information that was left out of the public report. And really, the people who are responsible for that ultimately is the administration. The president has the full discretion to classify and declassify information. You know, there are rumors floating around as to what information, you know, was left out. Rumors that it was Saudi ties to the terrorists. I did notice that there was not a lot of talk about the Saudi government, and I, you know, that's upsetting to me in light of the fact that we know as a fact that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi. We also know that there are money lines tying the Saudi princes to the hijackers. You know, that is obviously upsetting. But the reason why things were left out of the report, I really couldn't say. I just know that in the classification process, there is one entity that is responsible for what is classified and what is not classified, and that is undoubtedly the administration. I just want to clarify that it's not the administration, it's the president. It's so sad that this report took 6 months to be given to the public. It shouldn't have taken that long. Really, one of the biggest problems that we had prior to September 11th was informing the public. If the public knew in the summer of 2001 that we were under a threat of a terrorist attack, undoubtedly lives would have been saved. And I think it is so sad that it took 6 months to get this report to the public, because the public needs to be informed and the public needs to be educated, because we need to protect ourselves.
Bob Graham, the Democratic representative from Florida and the committee co-chairman, had started off this news conference yesterday by saying that the events of September 11th could have been prevented had it not been for institutional resistance to make counterterrorism work a higher priority. And he cited a number of problems within the intelligence community prior to September 11th, including a lack of information sharing and a series of proposed budget cuts. Do you have a feeling, and you and other 9/11 widows and family members, that someone or some agency should be held responsible for these oversights?
Listen, I'm a big believer in accountability, and I think that obviously there were huge failures on the morning of September 11th and prior to September 11th. I think that one of the reasons why we have pushed for an independent commission is to not only look at the intelligence agencies, which the joint inquiry did, but to look at all of the agencies and institutions that were responsible that morning. And certainly, when the independent commission's work is done, we hope that we will have more sunlight shining down on this tragedy. We need to have accountability. We need our leaders to be held responsible for their actions and their failure to act when it links up to September 11th.
Now, this joint congressional inquiry was separate from the 9/11 commission led by former New Jersey Governor Tom Kaine, which is still continuing its work. How will this congressional report likely affect the findings of that report, and when is it expected to be released?
I think first and foremost, it's definitely set quite a standard. The independent commission has a standard to live up to now. And in addition to that, it's undoubtedly an excellent springboard for the commission. We worked very well and very closely with the joint inquiry. In fact, they were our biggest supporters early on for the need for an independent commission. And I think the quality of the report that they put out yesterday, which in my opinion is outstanding, I'm speaking about the report that they were allowed to release. They fought for 6 months to get the report that we saw yesterday out. They lost some battles, mostly, it was all over classification. But the report that they were able to get to us was outstanding. And I think that, obviously the independent commission is going to be able to take away a lot of lessons from the joint inquiry and the battles that they had to fight.
Does the release of this report yesterday bring any sort of sense of closure to you and other September 11th family members?
Certainly, it let us know that the intelligence agencies were investigated. Obviously, as was made readily apparent at the press conferences yesterday, more work needs to be done. The investigation is not complete. The joint inquiry's report is incomplete because they ran out of time. There's a sense of... you feel some relief because you know that these commissioners, or rather these congressional officials, they served the country well. They did an excellent job, and they really, really did put forth a magnanimous effort towards making this nation safer by doing such a good job on the inquiry. But, there is still so much more work to be done. There are so many agencies and institutions, the FAA, the City of New York, the Port Authority, NORAD, the Defense Department, all of these areas have to be looked at, have to be investigated. We need to get answers as to why there was such a systemic failure on behalf of all these agencies on the morning of September 11th, not just the intelligence agencies.
Kristen Breitweiser, the widow of Ronald Breitweiser, who was working in Tower 2 on the 94th floor of the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. President Bush today ordered an unspecified number of U.S. troops to be positioned off the coast of war-torn Liberia to assist West African peacekeeping forces. The U.S. role will be limited, the White House said in a statement. The president has directed the Secretary of Defense to position appropriate military capabilities off the coast of Liberia to help support the peacekeeping force, it said. The statement did not say how many U.S. troops or ships would be involved. The immediate task of the West African Peacekeeping Force is to reinforce a ceasefire and begin to create conditions where humanitarian assistance can be provided to the Liberian people, according to the statement. The statement reiterated Bush's insistence that Liberian President Charles Taylor must leave. International relief workers have been pressing the White House for a decision, saying that a delay in sending in peacekeepers made it impossible to help the victims of the fighting. Bush has been mulling the decision since June when U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan and others began pleading with the U.S. to provide military assistance after the announcement of a new ceasefire accord. The question dogged Bush as he traveled through sub-Saharan Africa at the beginning of July, and throughout, Bush and senior aides said the U.S. likely would get involved because of the West African country's historical role as perhaps America's most dependable Cold War ally in Africa and its unique ties to the U.S. as a country founded by former slaves. Taylor has offered to step down and accept haven in Nigeria, but has given no time frame and has suggested he would not leave until an international peacekeeping force is in place. West African leaders have promised a multinational force for Liberia since soon after rebels opened offensives in June in Monrovia, a city of 1 million now crowded with hundreds of thousands of refugees. Meanwhile, mortar rounds thudded into the U.S. embassy compound homes and a school crowded with refugees in the bloodiest attack on Liberia's besieged capital in days, killing at least 12 Liberian men, women, and children. The Coalition of Concerned Liberians held a panel discussion earlier this week to debate whether outside troops are needed in their country, which troops would serve the crisis better, and when the forces should be slated to arrive. Peace Watch associate producer Angelique Shofar was there and files this report.
The Coalition of Concerned Liberians, a Washington-based nonprofit organization representing various humanitarian groups, friends, and concerned individuals, hosted a town hall meeting earlier this week to discuss the relevance of direct U.S. involvement in Liberia. Moderator Wilma Redd began by describing the reality of the war for those who have not experienced it.
Many of us here have not tasted the war. Many of us here have not seen the dead bodies. We haven't had to crawl to look for food. We haven't had to dig holes and bury our loved ones who are decaying and smelling. Many of us here have not really experienced the decadence and the downtrodden of the Liberian soil and the Liberian people. I say this so that we become a little bit aware and put ourselves in the place of those who are home. We sit here and we say we should do this, we should do that, this should happen, that should happen, and sometimes we're not mindful of those who it will affect most directly.
Krista Ridley, Africa advocate for Amnesty International, spoke of strategies that the U.S. should take to protect the human rights of Liberians.
They are obliged to protect civilians because we've seen in other conflicts that that's been a problem. We want to make sure that protection of civilians and clear access to humanitarian assistance is on the top of the list if the U.S. should go in or if any peacekeeping forces should go in. What we also need to see, though, is sort of the long-term peacekeeping forces coming in as a follow-on to bring in long-term stability in order to establish the rule of law, the respect for human rights, and to lay the foundations for a free and open political process that allows all Liberians to participate in the future of their country.
Also present was Salid Buka, Executive Director of Africa Action. Buka emphasized the urgency of the situation in Liberia and the U.S. position, as well as the promises Bush has yet to fulfill.
Let me say that I want to stress the urgency of the moment.
Yep.
We need to have a long-term strategy, obviously, and this struggle has been going on for a long time and it will continue, and we need to have a long-term strategy for our struggles. But tonight, I think we need to focus on the urgent moment at hand, because people are dying by the day, by the hour, by the minute. And people in this country know that, and they're not doing anything about it. And in fact, the White House has no intention of doing anything about it, and that is what we have to discuss. How do we change that? Before his recent trip to Africa, President Bush made a promise to Americans and to Liberians. He promised that the United States would, and I quote, help the people of Liberia find the path to peace. Faced with the media spotlight on the crisis in Liberia, the White House continued to pledge U.S. leadership. They've been pledging U.S. leadership now for 3 weeks. Before he went on his trip to Africa, they had meetings of the Pentagon, the National Security Council, the State Department, the White House, and they continued to say, we're considering all options. I would argue to you tonight that they decided in those meetings some 3 weeks ago that they had no intention of providing U.S. troops to lead a multinational force to help bring security and peace to the Liberian people. They wanted to make sure that during President Bush's trip to Africa, this issue did not undermine his trip. And so they sent a military assessment team to Monrovia so they could say, we're assessing the situation. The military assessment team in Monrovia didn't do a military assessment. They did a humanitarian assessment. They didn't do an assessment to prepare for the introduction of U.S. combat troops to secure the area.
That was Sally Booker of Africa Action. James Butte, Africa correspondent for the Voice of America, relayed information on plans for peacekeeping forces deployed by the Economic Community of West African States to enter Liberia to bring the situation under control.
The West African Community decided, their meeting in Senegal, Dakar, they decided that they are going to send the vanguard peacekeeping troops, basically two battalions from Nigeria. So the two battalions are going to go to Liberia. One is coming from Sierra Leone, where they are already engaged in a peacekeeping effort there, and the other one is coming from Nigeria. When I asked General Umar Diarra, who is the man in charge of the ECOWAS military and political affairs, he said, I was really interested in when would the troops be going in? First he said within a week, then he stressed within the next 2 weeks. So he said within the next 2 weeks. So I asked, will this vanguard force include soldiers from the United States? He said no, the vanguard force would not include U.S. Forces, but he said that they have gotten some support from the United States and the European Union. After 2 weeks, the rest of the 3,000 forces that have been promised by the ECOWAS will follow the two Nigerian battalions after 2 weeks. So we expect maybe if everything goes as he said, in the next 3 weeks or so, you'll have about 3,000 ECOWAS troops in Liberia.
James Butte also spoke of the peace negotiations currently taking place in Accra, Ghana, as well as the demands being made by the warring factions on their participation in the interim government.
About the peace process in Accra, Ghana, the different factions at the peace process submitted their proposals in terms of what the structure of the interim government that will replace Charles Taylor, even when he leaves, will look like. The two warring factions, Model and Lur, would like at least the interim government should have about two vice presidents and at least a time period for the interim government of at least 24 months. Well, when the facilitators returned, when it came back to the different factions, they said that the interim government will have a president and a vice president, and they excluded the two warring factions. So those of us who understand what is happening, we kind of think that the reason that there's been this upsurge in fighting in Monrovia is the two factions did not like what was coming out of Ghana. But they wouldn't say that. They say they believe in the peace process. So all the two rebel groups want is that they agree that they don't want to lead the interim government, but they want two vice presidents in the interim government. One of the vice presidents will be from Model, the other one from Lur. Tonight, they were even telling me that even Charles Taylor government supports them and we'd like to have three vice presidents. So the argument they are making is that they are the three groups that signed the ceasefire. So when I asked him, now what do you say to those who would say, this is why you have been fighting all along, you wanted power? He said, no, if we wanted power, Model had 38,000 troops. We started in March. It took us less time to capture seven counties. If we wanted power, we would have reached Monrovia within a week and take over the government. But we believe in talking to our own people to come up with some process.
James Butte, Africa correspondent for the Voice of America. Meanwhile, the U.S. government has spoken of plans to send a minimal amount of troops to intervene, while Liberians and international observers say this mission will require a much greater number of forces to secure peace and stability. Again, Salih Booker of Africa Action.
And you all may know what they're now talking about, which I hope people in this room will not succumb to. They are talking about hiring private military contractors. They are talking about hiring mercenaries and bounty hunters who are offering that, yeah, they can go in at cheaper costs and arrest Taylor and stop the fighting. That's what they're promising the White House, and the White House is considering it.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Angelique Shofar.
I had come into the city carrying life in my eyes amid rumors of death, calling out to everyone who would listen, it is time to move us all into another century, time for freedom and racial and sexual justice, time for women and children and men, time for hands unbound. I had come into the city wearing peaceful breasts and the spaces between us smile. I had come into the city carrying life in my eyes. And they followed us in their cars with their computers and their tongues crawled with caterpillars. And they bumped us off the road, turned over our cars. And they bombed our buildings, killed our babies. And they slaughtered our doctors, maintaining our bodies. And their courts changed into confessionals. But we kept on organizing, we kept on teaching, believing, loving, doing what was holy, moving to a higher ground, even though our hands were full of slaughtered teeth. But we held out our eyes, delirious with grace. But we held out our eyes, delirious with grace.
Three Dominican nuns were sentenced in a Denver courtroom today to several years in prison for an anti-war protest that's drawn international attention and raised questions over the legality of the U.S.'s so-called first strike nuclear arsenal. Sam Fuqua has this report.
Catholic sisters Ardith Platy, Carol Gilbert, and Jackie Hudson received federal prison terms of between 2.5 and 3.5 years. The sentences varied based on the number of prior convictions for each of the women. All of them are veterans of civil resistance. Two of the nuns are part of Jonah House, an international community in Baltimore that's at the heart of the Plowshares anti-nuclear movement. At the sentencing, the nuns wore black and sat in silence in solidarity with the international anti-war group Women in Black. But before the hearing, 67-year-old Ardith Platy said she and her fellow sisters made a necessary sacrifice.
It's a sacrifice. It's a great sacrifice to be away from our families and our friends and our communities. But it will take great sacrifice for peace. I mean, as war is waged with the sacrifice of taxpayers and people who, you know, go to the battlefields and who kill other people and who are killed, the dimension of our activity must be, I think, comparable in waging peace.
Last October, the three Catholic sisters cut through chains and entered the gates of an underground Minuteman III missile silo in northeastern Colorado. They hammered the silo's lid and drew crosses on it with their own blood. They were jailed and convicted of obstructing national defense and damaging government property. During this sentencing, Federal District Judge Robert Blackburn said from the bench that he did not think the nuns acted in a courageous or honorable way. Blackburn said the Air Force personnel who responded to the protest and took the nuns into custody were the ones who showed courage. Federal prosecutors said sentencing guidelines showed that the nuns should get 6 to 8 years each in prison. Defense attorney Walter Garash says 2.5 to 3.5 years is better than he expected. Garash represented Sister Jackie Hudson.
I think the judge, he says he didn't bend to national, international pressure, but he mentioned those thousands of letters from all over the world. And also he found that there was no damage done to the national defense. So the judge was pretty good in that regard.
Judge Blackburn also directed the Bureau of Prisons to give the nuns credit for the 6 months that they already served in a county jail for the crimes. John Southers is U.S. Attorney for the 10th District. He says his office wants the sentences to be a warning.
Our objective in the case was simply to get a consequence that would act as a specific deterrent to these three individual defendants and a general deterrent to those who may be inclined to bypass all the lawful means of protest available to them and choose instead, like these defendants did, to violate the law by entering onto a sensitive military installation and damaging federal property.
But the case seems to be having the opposite effect in Colorado. On Saturday, protesters will fan out to nuclear missile silos across the northeastern part of the state in an event called Adopt a Silo. No civil disobedience is planned, but organizers say it's the latest of many events in solidarity with the three nuns. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Sam Fuqua in Denver.
Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke with Sister Artith Plotty last January as she was in prison awaiting sentencing.
It's time for disarmament. It's time for disarming not only the weapons of mass destruction, but the violence that is in our hearts, the bitterness and demonization of people of other nations. We must begin to use the International World Court for these kinds of persons who commit war crimes. But we can't continue to commit war crimes and then claim that we are on the right track and getting other people to stop war crimes. We must model everything that we want and we desire. We definitely feel that this is a political prisoner status that we will hold. Prosecutors and the judges of this nation have a real responsibility to look inside themselves and see whether or not they're going to be able to uphold it in the future.
Dominican Sister Artith Plotty speaking with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian. The nuns were disappointed at today's ruling, but they said they were prepared to accept imprisonment as a spiritual experience. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Pictures of the slain sons of Saddam Hussein have circulated around the world. In an exclusive interview with the Times of London, the bodyguard of Uday Hussein spoke out for the first time, claiming that Saddam Hussein and his sons did not flee Baghdad during the bombing, but rather held out in the capital for at least a week after its fall. He said that they evaded repeated American attempts to assassinate or capture them and even appeared in public under the noses of U.S. troops. The bodyguard told the newspaper that Saddam suspected an informant in his camp when the Americans' so-called decapitation strikes began hitting closer to the safe houses in which Saddam was hiding. Saddam then directed the suspected captain to set up a safe house behind a restaurant in the Mansour district for a meeting. Saddam and company arrived and went immediately out the back door. 10 minutes later, the house was bombed. Saddam had the captain he suspected summarily executed while the Pentagon was claiming the strike had killed Saddam and his son who died. Meanwhile, the questions of whether the Bush administration overstated the threat posed by Saddam to mislead the country into launching the brutal campaign of shock and awe against the people of Iraq continues. In an article in the New Republic magazine, Spencer Ackerman and John B. Judas wrote, quote, "Foreign policy is always difficult in a democracy. Democracy requires openness, yet foreign policy requires a level of secrecy that frees it from oversight and exposes it to abuse," end quote. Peace Watch sat down with Assistant Editor Spencer Ackerman earlier this week and asked him to talk about this principle in the context of the post-September 11th world that we now live in and the trust that the American people placed in Bush when he used confidential intelligence info to justify the war in Iraq.
It's a difficult position for any open society to be in when facing an imminent danger or a danger that materializes as it did so horribly on September 11th. National security information is classified for a reason. There are certain aspects of information that we simply, as citizens, can't know about for various reasons of safety and security. Nevertheless, our political system requires us as citizens to make decisions based on as much information as possible. And so skirting that balance is incredibly difficult, particularly in a time of terror. And without vigilant guardianship, and an appropriate respect for that balance, the system opens itself up for abuse. And I believe that it's one of the most important principles that needs to be upheld to make sure that abuse doesn't happen. And in the post-September 11th world, it's not just going to be an issue for this president on this issue of Iraq or al-Qaeda, for that matter. It's going to be an issue for every subsequent administration that faces a threat like we do from al-Qaeda.
Is it your opinion that the Bush administration actually abused that power?
I think the evidence that we know of so far makes a decent prima facie case that there was abuse from the White House and from the Defense Department. How deep it ran, we don't quite know yet. How serious it is, we don't quite know yet. But with some of the reporting that we did, we talked to various officials in the intelligence community, and we came away convinced that whether there was intentional abuse that went forward, perhaps that wasn't the case, although it remains to be seen, but certainly some of the intelligence analysts felt that they were being pressured to make their reports fit a preconceived policy.
Mm-hmm. So in light of these recent admissions that we're hearing from the White House, would you say that our intelligence agencies were insulated from political interference in the lead up to the war?
It seems to be that insulation is somewhat of a platonic ideal of how political appointees in various agencies and elements of the executive branch should interface with the intelligence community. And that insulation appears to have been broken down.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you claim that the administration ignored and even suppressed disagreement within the intelligence agencies and pressured the CIA to reaffirm the administration's preferred version of the threat that Iraq supposedly presented. What's the basis of your assertion for that?
There are several different elements of that. To take just one example that's come to light recently, the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research during the spring and the summer of 2002 was asked to assess, as were the rest of the intelligence community, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, what precisely the threat was from Saddam Hussein's reconstituted or allegedly reconstituted nuclear weapons program. And there were a few pieces of intelligence data that the intelligence communities had collected, perhaps most infamously now, accusations of alleged procurements of uranium, yellow cake from Niger, and alleged shipments of aluminum tubes for perhaps a reconstituted nuclear weapons program. And when INR, as the Bureau of Intelligence and Research is known, talked with the experts within the U.S. intelligence community, particularly Department of Energy nuclear scientists, and assessed the actual evidence that we had of these aluminum tube shipments coming into Iraq, what they came to find was that these tubes were not suitable for a nuclear weapons program, and they would have to be doctored in various technical ways in order to enrich uranium in what's called a cascade enrichment. And so they came to the conclusion that this was simply not evidence of a nuclear weapons program. And the more they brought that view forward in various closed-door meetings last spring and last summer, more and more they faced resistance from higher and higher level officials in the CIA who were rather convinced that the intelligence simply showed that these aluminum tubes were only for a nuclear weapons program, which was an accusation that Condoleezza Rice made on television, the National Security Advisor, in September of 2002. And so quickly, over the course of these next several weeks, it became clear that INR and the more expert intelligence analysts on the nuclear issue had a view that was becoming more and more marginalized. And when ultimately the National Intelligence Estimate was written over the course of a couple weeks in September and eventually published in a declassified form in October, the INR's position, which was also, I should add, the position of some other intelligence analysts in the CIA and DIA, became more and more of a marginalized position until it became ultimately, as newly declassified elements of that NIE, which were made public on Friday, reveal, it was simply relegated to a footnote in a larger case. And that case was stated with very little equivocation and very little balance, that these tubes simply, as a matter of intelligence, indicated nothing else but the existence of a reconstituted nuclear weapons program. And that's something that happens on a variety of issues in the CIA, on the links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, on other elements, as we're finding out with the Niger yellowcake uranium, which ended up in the president's State of the Union. And on and on and on, these issues appeared both within the intelligence community and in the intelligence community's presentation to Congress and in the administration's presentation to the public. Doubts were sort of written out of existence in public presentation, and sketchy intelligence became translated into certainty, as the president would constantly say and his lieutenants would constantly say. These are things we know. These are things that intelligence clearly shows.
Abuse of the power.
I think you can make a strong case, based on what we know right now, that the process simply broke down.
In deflecting criticism over the inaccurate statements Bush made concerning Iraq's supposed attempts to obtain uranium from Africa, the White House has repeatedly said that these were just simply 16 words out of the entire State of the Union address, and that the case for war was built on much more than this single point alone. How significant was this, in your opinion?
I think it was ultimately very significant for two reasons. One, the 16 words indicate part of a broader pattern of how the administration translated uncertainty, ambiguity, unclear information, information that could be interpreted to fit an alternative theory, into certainty to the public. I think that's primarily one of the reasons that this issue simply doesn't go away for the White House, and nor do I think will it over the course of the next several weeks. But there's another reason this is significant, and that is simply substantively on the case for war. We were told repeatedly over the last year that Iraq presented a grave and gathering threat to American security. And what I would say would be the most compelling aspect of that case would be the prospect of a madman, a mass murderer, someone who has committed genocide, someone who has invaded his neighbors twice, on two different occasions, that is, possessing the world's most dangerous weapons, those being nuclear weapons. And what the National Intelligence Estimate said in October, and as the president said in his State of the Union speech, and was the case that he made as well in October of 2002 in Cincinnati, and his administration made in other fora, if Iraq acquired fissile material from abroad, then the National Intelligence Estimate said, we would see a case where Saddam Hussein would have a nuclear weapon in about a year. And that presents an imminent security risk to the United States. And so basically the administration puts out the line that this was part and parcel of a broader picture, which is true. We also heard much discussion about Saddam Hussein's chemical and biological weapons programs, as well as human rights abuses, his record of aggression, which is undeniable. But I would say when the administration needed to present the case for war as being an issue that the United States needed to deal with immediately, the nuclear weapons case was more or less front and center. And in that case, the administration placed the prospect of Saddam acquiring uranium from Africa at the center of that.
Now, a great deal has been made out of the fact that the National Intelligence Estimate, prepared for Congress by the CIA, included the language about the uranium from Africa, even though it had been discredited. And it was
I was kind of intrigued by the implications that the CIA and the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, were pressured by the administration to include these qualified statements in the classified report presented to the Congressional Intelligence Committee. You've talked a little bit about that already. I just want a brief outline of that process and what the differences were in the two reports that misled the Congress over the real threat posed by Saddam Hussein.
Well, what seems to have happened over the course of the last year with the CIA is that analysts at Langley, the CIA's headquarters, started getting visits from very senior White House officials, including Vice President Dick Cheney, his chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, and others in the administration. And this is not something that happens very routinely. It's not unprecedented, I should say that, but it is not a regular occurrence. The president and the vice president receive intelligence briefings every morning. To have the vice president and his top aides visit very low-level analysts at Langley is not something that, as our sources have told to us, something that analysts deal with very well. It simply becomes whether the vice president makes it plain. I doubt he would, and it may in fact not even have been his intention, although it remains to be seen. But certainly the analysts, many of them, and certain officials in the CIA got the message that the White House was looking for a given interpretation in the intelligence that it was receiving.
Dick Cheney visited these low-level analysts how frequently?
It's not clear yet, but there were several visits that occurred in the summer of 2002 to Langley that Cheney or his chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, undertook.
Mm-hmm.
The extent to which still remains to be seen.
And he actually spoke to the analyst?
Directly, yes.
Directly. Is there any record of what was said?
Not yet, no. That still remains to be seen.
But even something like that, while unusual and inappropriate perhaps, has it stepped over any line of protocol or propriety or legalities?
Right. You're right to point out that it's not unprecedented. These visits have happened by senior administration officials in other administrations in the past. They're not without precedent. However, on an issue as sensitive as this, and on any issue for that matter, the CIA institutionally has a culture of independence that it seeks to create something of a firewall between political actors in any administration and its analysts in order to preserve what it seeks to present, which is the integrity of intelligence uncolored by political considerations. And simply put, I don't believe these analysts and these CIA officials would be talking to the press about the extent of these visits if they did not feel that these visits were intended to sway the analysts in one way or another on given issues regarding Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Dick Cheney was among those in the administration that wanted to move forward with the invasion of
That's
Iraq.
That's true.
Whereas you had the State Department and Colin Powell choosing a more moderate path, quote unquote.
I think that's largely true, although the extent to which that's true is somewhat, I think, a bit of a caricature or an oversimplification. Secretary Powell, I happen to know, received a memo in March 2002 from the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research telling him, by the way, the Bureau of Intelligence and Research exists primarily as part of the intelligence community to provide the Secretary of State with information.
Mm-hmm.
The Bureau of Intelligence and Research sent Secretary Powell a memo in May 2002 informing him of the doubts that the Bureau had about whether Iraq was really acquiring uranium from Niger. And yet this information, 10 months later, appears in a State Department press release, in a fact sheet that they present in late December 2002 about Iraq's weapons declaration that it gave on December 5th, that you'll recall the 12,000-page declaration about its weapons programs. Mm-hmm. The State Department released a sheet saying, more or less, what is Saddam Hussein hiding by not disclosing his uranium purchases from Africa? So while it is true that the State Department pursued a more internationalist path toward the war, the difference may or may not be as great as some in the media have made it out
mm-hmm.
to be.
At the same time, however, Colin Powell did delete that reference in the address that he was to give before the United Nations, the reference to Saddam Hussein attempting to acquire uranium from Niger.
Indeed, he did, although he's never answered questions about how it could be that he received a memorandum in March of last year.
And it still showed up.
And it still shows up in a subsequent release that his department put out. But indeed, you're right. He did delete quite a bit of what he considered to be questionable intelligence from his February 5th presentation to the United Nations Security Council.
And so now we're hearing where Condoleezza Rice is taking responsibility for that statement. What do you make of that?
I saw her top deputy, Stephen Hadley, made a very startling admission in an impromptu briefing, I believe it was, that he had received memorandum from the CIA on October 5th and 6th, the days before the president's statement outlining the case for a war in Cincinnati of last year, telling him that the CIA did not have confidence in a line that the president was to deliver about a shipment of 500 tons, I could be wrong about that, of yellow cake from Niger. And subsequently, Hadley received a phone call from CIA Director George Tenet imploring him to strike the line, as ultimately Hadley did or made sure happened. And in fact, on July 11th, when Rice was aboard Air Force One en route to Entebbe in Uganda, she gave a rather combative briefing to the press corps informing them that the CIA delivered to the administration a national intelligence estimate that we talked about that said, and she said no less than five times that the CIA, mentioned uranium from other places in Africa going to Iraq, and repeatedly emphasized that no one in the White House had known about the doubts that the CIA had about this intelligence. And that was, you'll recall, the briefing where she called out Director Tenet personally to take responsibility. So over the next couple of days, I would expect that the National Security Advisor will be under quite a bit of pressure to see if she will take responsibility as her top deputy has, or whether the fact that her deputy, Stephen Hadley, has taken responsibility means that Condoleezza Rice will not. However, Hadley mentioned in his briefing that one of the memos he received, I believe it was the October 6th memorandum, was also addressed to National Security Advisor Rice.
And of course, CIA Director George Tenet initially took partial responsibility for this line ending up in the president's State of the Union address.
That he did.
What kind of effect does all of this have on the Bush administration's credibility, in your opinion?
Well, I think now George Bush's greatest political asset was the fact that he's painted himself quite successfully up to this point as the opposite of his predecessor, that he is not someone who parses words legalistically and carefully. He will present the unvarnished truth to the American people. Sometimes it'll get him into trouble for doing that, as it has on several occasions, like when he implored Iraqi guerrillas to bring him on, meaning attacks on American forces. And this appears to undercut that very significant political asset that he's held. Over the past 60 days, polling data has shown that he's gone from still being perceived as a wartime president with approval ratings in the high 60s and the low 70s to dipping down into the mid 50s, which is an astonishing drop in public credibility over the past 2 months alone. And it appears to have picked up steam over these last several weeks the flap over Niger uranium has come to light. So it is presenting, although it is somewhat premature, a serious political problem to the Bush administration.
So you think that heretofore he was perceived as, you know, just kind of a straight-talking cowboy?
I think that's generally the perception that he sought to cultivate.
And so your article appeared in The New Republic. What kind of response have you received, and do many observers and academics on the right, as well as members of the Bush's own Republican Party that you've spoken with, do they share your concerns?
Well, we've had some articles that have come out, principally from right-wing publications, from conservative publications, I should probably say, that have taken exception to some of the things we've published, that have tried to refute the article on various substantive grounds. And so it appears to have, as was our intention, sparked a debate about the issues that our reporting raised. And so I think that's a positive thing. What I haven't seen from the right wing, especially from those who would advocate a preemptive security policy, and I would count myself as one who would argue that sometimes preemptive military action is warranted and necessary for the protection of American security. An implication in our piece is that if the president's credibility, if the administration's credibility because of this issue is diminished, then it will be increasingly hard for future situations which may indeed require preventive military action. To take two examples, perhaps a nuclear Iran or perhaps a nuclear North Korea, perhaps as well the prospect of a nuclear Pakistan falling into the hands of anti-American Islamists. There will be situations perhaps in the future that may warrant preemptive military action, and I would think that those primarily on the right who have advocated such a security doctrine for the past several years would want this issue laid to rest in as open and as public a manner. Otherwise, it risks undermining the very bases, meaning intelligence, for taking preventive military action.
Let's back up a little bit to September 11th again. We talked about that earlier. After September 11th, 2001, the administration claimed repeatedly that Saddam Hussein had ties to al-Qaeda. Secretary of State Colin Powell mentioned that there was evidence of conversations between the Hussein regime and al-Qaeda going back as long as a decade. What did your research uncover regarding al-Qaeda ties to Iraq, if anything?
That intelligence analysts working on the issue increasingly over the past year or so were not really able to come up with what Donald Rumsfeld called in September bulletproof evidence linking Saddam Hussein to Osama bin Laden. In fact, much of what the president used to source his public statements about a link between al-Qaeda and Iraq were testimonials from some of the al-Qaeda and Taliban that we have in custody in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere. But more senior al-Qaeda lieutenants, for instance, Ramzi bin al-Shaib, who was captured in September in Pakistan, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the architect of September 11th, and Abu Zubaydah, who we captured, I believe, in the spring of 2002, have all contradicted that line. And so it's strange to note, and it hasn't really been noted yet by the administration, that the bases for these statements, like I say, Donald Rumsfeld had argued that there were bulletproof evidence linking Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. This evidence doesn't seem to have been materialized. It seems to have been contradicted in a variety of instances. And analysts who worked on the issue for several years aver that there is no such link, certainly not to the degree that the administration has claimed. I don't think the book is closed on this issue yet. I think there probably is quite a lot more that we have to find out about. But I also think that rummaging through the intelligence directorate's files in Baghdad, you could probably discover quite a bit about this relationship. And it strikes me as strange that an administration that's on the defensive about issues in intelligence that it perhaps has not been quite so forthright about would not have held very frequent and very high-profile briefings to demonstrate any links that it would have subsequently found.
Well, speaking before Congress and in a meeting with President Bush, British Prime Minister Tony Blair said that even in the worst case scenario, if weapons are never found in Iraq and the U.S. and U.K. turn out to be wrong, history will understand that they still did the right thing for removing a brutal dictator. What's your reaction to that?
Frankly, I agree with Prime Minister Blair. We've known for about 20 years now, the perfidies of Saddam Hussein. This is a genocidal dictator, and I make no apologies for the fact that the United States and Britain overthrew him. And what ultimately the Prime Minister's statements should mean is that what history will not judge with any exculpation, perhaps, is whether the United States and Britain don't follow through on their commitments to engender a rebirth of Iraq as a free and democratic society.
So you support the overthrow of a brutal dictator in another country. You don't support that the people of Iraq should be allowed to run their country, to have a sovereign nation, and to, if there's a brutal dictator there, they should be allowed to overthrow him.
Well, I certainly believe that Iraq ought to be a situation where its own internal political dissent is expressed in a way that would have overthrown the Saddam Hussein regime. But this was simply not a situation where that could have occurred. Saddam Hussein ran what the Iraqi dissident Kenan Makiya rather eloquently called a republic of fear, which ruled in perfect totalitarian fashion by making its enemies complicit in its crimes through a variety of rather revolting and horrifying mechanisms. Most importantly, it's multifaceted state intelligence and secret police organizations. So whereas in an ideal world, outside military intervention would not have been necessary to destroy such a monstrous regime, in this case, I really don't see how any other alternative could have deposed Saddam Hussein, and for that matter, led to a situation in which Saddam Hussein did not pass on his disgusting legacy to his two genocidal and megalomaniacal sons, Uday and Qusay, who were killed in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there were other nations around the world that felt that the UN inspection process should have been given a chance to play itself out, and that a preemptive strike, which was used in this case, was not necessary. The UN inspectors took a beating, in fact, in the U.S. press, and according to The New Republic, Cheney assaulted the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying, if you look at the track record of the IAEA, they have consistently underestimated or missed what it was Saddam Hussein was doing, end quote. Cheney referred to the actions of Hussein prior to the Gulf War. Please explain how this statement mischaracterized the facts in terms of the IAEA's role prior to the Gulf War.
What I would say about Dick Cheney's rather striking public statements that was on Meet the Press in mid-March, a few days before the war started, he assaulted the credibility of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and he in particular assaulted the credibility of its Director General, Mohammed Al-Baradei. However, for the past several months, the IAEA had informed through various channels the United States and the British governments that it was finding on the ground in Iraq a far different picture than what the United States and Britain presented of a reconstituted nuclear weapons program. And rather forthrightly, it did not surprise the U.S. or the U.K. with this information. It briefed them through various channels about what it was fun. Perhaps brief is not the right word, but it made clear to the U.S. and the U.K. that the facts on the ground were not what the U.S. and U.K. were describing, mm-hmm. nor was the intelligence that the U.S. and U.K. giving to the IAEA of the sort of credibility that you would normally expect from a high-level administration argument. For instance, Jacques Bote, the chief IAEA inspector in Iraq, used the search engine Google to determine the fraudulence of some of these documents that seemed to indicate Iraq was trying to procure large amounts of yellowcake uranium from Niger. And they allowed for the U.S. and U.K. to know what they were finding. And repeatedly, they said, if we are missing something, if there is more information, if we're simply going about this in a way that perhaps doesn't make much sense, what can you tell us that would disabuse us of these perhaps mistakes? Mm-hmm. And again, the message came back that there was no more information that would be shared about this. And in the case of the Niger uranium forgeries, the US and UK informed the IAEA that not only were they not contesting the IAEA's interpretation, but that there was no separate intelligence that the U.S. or U.K. had, which is much different from what the British government is now saying. So for Dick Cheney to say in public something that completely contradicted what his government's officials were telling the IAEA in private is quite astonishing.
Spencer Ackerman, assistant editor of The New Republic and co-author with John B. Judas of the article The First Casualty that appeared in the June 30th issue of the magazine. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammond of KPFA and Keith Chalgion. Thanks to Pete Karak at RadioForAll.net and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.